Well, while we're getting this, let me just say that pretty much the two talks prior to this, and probably most of the talks that will occur during this this meeting, could start with the phrase, given a tumor, these are its properties. And these are the different aspects of tumor biology that are important. I'm actually going to address a somewhat different subject, which is, how does the tumor get there in the first place? What are the processes which govern carcinogenesis, which is the process by which normal cells become malignant cells through a series of intermediates? And soon I'll be doing hand puppets on the thing. Do you want me just to bring up my computer?
Mm-hmm. I know what it is.
What? Oh my God.
Bizarre window here. Trying to read another computer that's not attached. Yeah, that's the
trick. What kind of attachment do you have there?
It's not one of the computers. Yeah, Allison is the I just put it tighter so it should just.
Is that going here?
No.
No, it won't go in here. Okay. Yeah, Paula is funny.
Another thing you can do is to turn it off and turn it on.
Okay. Yeah,
they're
okay.
Oh, but that's
yeah.
There. That's
yeah. So put this.
So
is it on there?
No.
Put this on.
Arrangement.
No.
There you go. Thank you, John.
Okay, so again, I'm going to talk about carcinogenesis. I'm going to particularly talk about the evolution of cancer, and I'm going to sprinkle in a few quotes from the master, Dr. Darwin. When I was in medical school, and I think my guess is that many people, particularly who are mathematicians here, think about cancer as forming this way. You start with a normal cell, something happens. You know, some magical thing occurs. You know, you get some kind of genetic mutation, and you get a cancer cell that then grows, forming kind of a ball of cancers, and that then just progresses to invasion of metastatic disease. That's kind of how we thought about it when I went to medical school. And since then, there's been a substantial change in the conceptual model of carcinogenesis. Now, instead of a single event that occurs very, very rapidly, we know that what happens is that cancer occurs in a stepwise fashion, not in a day, not even in months, but probably in decades. And what happens is that you begin with some kind of normal tissue, you get a mutation in one cell, and that confers a proliferative advantage, and that's an important concept and a phrase that gets used over and over again. I'll try to define that better. As we go on. And that creates a new population of mutant cells. This is not a cancer, this is just a pre-malignant population. And then another mutation occurs, which confers yet another selective growth advantage. You get an outgrowth of that population, so you get progressive clonal expansions that occur over decades sometimes, until finally what emerges from that is this, is a clinical cancer. This process is now commonly described as somatic evolution. And so the principles of evolution, of the Darwinian dynamics, are commonly thought about, or can be potentially applicable to this sort of thing. In fact, the conference that Dan and I went to in Virginia just a couple of weeks ago was explicitly on this very subject of evolution and cancer. Part of the reason that this is looked at as evolution is that you can see a change in the appearance of the tissue over time as it goes progressively from normal. And you can see this is the crypts of the colon, very well structured cells, everything's very regular. This is not a cancer, this is a dysplastic colon. So these are the same kind of cysts, but you can see visibly how different they are. They're less well organized, they're bigger, there's less interstitial tissue, interstitial space, and nuclei themselves, instead of all being layered around the basement membrane, they have to come in toward the lumen. This gets progressively more disordered until you actually have this final cancer, which in this case is an undifferentiated cancer, and really bears no resemblance, has no of this initial order of the tissue. The sort of iconic model of cancer, of carcinogenesis, is this Ferenc-Vogelstein diagram, which was published in 1990. And basically what they propose is, this is largely on empiric data, that you can say that a specific mutation will occur at specific times during this evolution of a cancer, and that each mutation will lead to the change in the morphology of the tissue. So you start with this hyperplastic proliferation, early adenoma, sequence of events, another intermediate adenoma, and so that you get this progression. You can link that change in the appearance of the tissue to specific mutations. And while this is probably shouldn't be taken too seriously, this is not really a model that this kind of sequence of events doesn't really occur characteristically in cancer. It's more of a pedagogic thing. This idea of a sequence of mutations driving the process, I think, is pretty well accepted. And the idea that there are late and early changes that occur, characteristically at least observed in carcinogenesis. And so this is the sort of evolution from normal through a series of pre-malignant lesions to finally a cancer. So this idea of carcinogenesis as in vivo evolution is intuitively appealing, and it's used all the time by cancer biologists. But I should argue it's not really applied very rigorously. There's a number of open questions in this. So, you know, we use this term proliferative growth advantage, and mutation confers a proliferative growth advantage. But what does that mean exactly? What actually does it do that allows the cells to proliferate? Why do you see the mutations in that typical sequence? Why are they occurring? Why do you get certain things early in carcinogenesis and certain things, you know, later in carcinogenesis? And then how does all of that ultimately end up a cancer? The hallmarks of cancer, someone showed the picture of the hallmarks at plus one recently in one of the previous talks. You know, how does all this, you know, kind of finally funnel down to the ball of cells, you know, this mass that we call cancer? The other thing is it actually gives us kind of an interesting opportunity to work cancer as an inverse problem in the sense that we know what cancers do. We know their properties. And we know that in a Darwinian environment, any consistent phenotypic property of a population always is the result of specific and identifiable selection forces and always will confer a competitive advantage. So using the hallmarks of cancer, using properties that we can observe in cancer, we in some ways can look backwards and say, well, what are those, what, you know, how did those, you know, evolve? What specific selection forces do they answer? So consider the Darwinian dynamics of invasion. This is the red British squirrel. This is a North American gray squirrel. As you probably know, the gray squirrel was introduced into England and is now progressively wiping out this guy. What is it about this cell, in this case, or this rodent, or whatever, that allows it, that allows it to overcome this guy? So there's one, there's a component about the phenotype. What are the properties of the individual? But there's also the context of it. Which of the things here are invasive species? Well, if you're in North America, it's this African grass in the background. If you're in Africa, it's the flowers. The point being that the environment and the context of the environment is an important factor in understanding the invasion of one species into another, which is really what cancers are. And in Darwin finches, it's important to realize that the changes in the body habitus and the beak morphology did not occur by magic. It occurred because they were adapting to specific environments on the different islands, which promoted certain properties. So when we think about how properties in tumors evolve during over time, we can't separate them from the adaptive forces, from the environmental selection forces, which really are sculpting them. So what were Darwin's postulates? Heritable variations within populations produce phenotypic diversity. There's a couple of things to point out here. There's heritable genes, and there's phenotype. We talk a great deal about genes, but evolutionary selection occurs at the phenotypic level. And it's important to think about this is, and tumor cells are a very heterogeneous population. There's a struggle for existence. So what we're going to assume is that during carcinogenesis, there is a competitive environment, and that the cells are competing with each other in order to survive and reproduce. And that these phenotypic properties affect that struggle. And of course, we have to remember that the environment is not itself constant. The environment can change due to outside forces, as shown here with the dinosaurs, or it can change because the individuals themselves are changing it. These dinosaurs may also have overgrazed this land, and as a result of that, food supplies may have been limited. So that there's a sort of twofold thing here. We've got evolution of tumor cells, and we also have evolution of environment. Those are and the selection forces that the environment is producing. We need to accommodate all of those things when we think about how cancers develop. So we can think about carcinogenesis as an evolutionary game. Now here, cells are the players. The heritable states are the strategies. As they are as they are expressed in phenotypic changes, cells inherit rather than choose, that's obvious, and the per capita growth rates are the payoff. So in this case, fitness equals growth. And here, the environment sets the rules. Now we can, and I'm not going to push too much for to talk about the math, but we can develop a group of strategies which are available to cells. Think about the phenotypes of dogs, and understand that represents the heritable capability of a wolf, and the struggle for existence can be generated through this per capita growth. We use what's called the fitness generating function. So what we do is we take the vector of all extant cell populations and their strategy. U is the strategy. X is the vector for the different populations that express these strategies. And we have a virtual variable V here, which then looks at any available strategy and how those strategies will fare in that particular environment. We can set up the equations, and what this G function does is expresses in a geometric fashion the adaptive landscape. We place different cell populations on the adaptive landscape and watch both the landscape and the cells evolve together. This is the kind of fundamental growth equation that we use for in vivo populations. Basically, the proliferation of the population is dependent on two general factors. One is the normal tissue growth constraints. These are the interactions with the extracellular matrix, with the microenvironmental cells, and so forth. This is the sort of the tissue piece of it. And then we also say that you have to have enough substrate available. In other words, you can't proliferate if you don't have enough oxygen, glucose, and other substrate to make new cells or to at least survive. Of course, in normal tissue, in all of us, this is how our cells are constrained. We assume that substrate availability is always no problem. Under pathologic conditions like stroke or heart attack or diabetic ulcers, this may become dominant and you may actually lose cells because there's not enough substrate to sustain them. But under normal circumstances, we assume that this is what's controlling our cells and what's preventing us from having cancers. And that's what we find, is that if you run these models, the initial proliferation is dependent on changes in that first term, and it looks very, very much like the Ferrer and Vogelstein model. But the problem is that we show that this is not enough to make cancer. And the reason is that this is the growth of the cells. It actually plateaus and you end up with a self-limited population. The reason is that substrate concentrations decline. And what happens is that instead of this term becoming dominant and controlling proliferation, this term does. Now, this is an unusual, to a cancer biologist, this is a stunning result because the idea that substrate limitation might play a significant role in the development of cancer is not in any of those models. With the Ferrer and Vogelstein model or pretty much anything else that develops that has been used, the idea that there is some substrate limitation has simply never shown up. Does that make sense? And this actually led us to go back and re-look at how cancers develop. And you know, this is one of the things that people have looked at for 100 years. But the significance of it is not necessarily appreciated. What we realized that upon looking at this is that tumors, this is a duct, this is a breast duct. Ordinarily, the breast duct just consists of a single cell of epithelial cell layer, a single layer of epithelial cells. As the tumors grow, as it proliferates, it grows into the lumen. The basement membrane, which is here, remains intact by definition. An invasive cancer does not develop until the basement membrane is breached, and therefore all premalignant growth occurs within the basement membrane. The endothelial cells, the blood vessels, the fibroblasts, and other mesenchyma remain on the opposite side of the basement membrane. So what happens is that as these guys go further and further away, everything that's made, everything that comes to them from the blood vessels must diffuse over longer and longer distances. And now you can see, well, gee, there's hypoxia. I mean, there's necrosis in the center of this. Well, that's because they've run out of, you know, blood supply. So we began to think about the physiology and anatomy of basement membranes and the role that those play in the development of ductal carcinoma in situ and other and carcinogenesis in general. And so what we initially focused on was the role of hypoxia and substrate limitation. And so what we've proposed then is that as the tumor cells grow, become more hyperproliferative and grow away from the basement membrane, they get further and further away from the blood vessels. This becomes a diffusion reaction kinetics, and this area becomes hypoxic. So that this prediction of substrate limitation during carcinogenesis actually makes complete sense if you understand the anatomy of carcinoma in situ. We then modeled this in some detail. This is work with Philip Maney and Kieran Smallbone at Oxford. We start with this kind of layer of cells, and I don't want to go into the details too much, but these are normal. What we do is allow each cell to evolve into different phenotypic properties and have those rewarded if they confer proliferative advantage. So I'll talk about this a little bit more. So this is the beginnings. What we find is that the first cells that are selected are going, are those that are hyperproliferative. These are the ones that have that first term loss where they no longer have tissue constraints. But what we find is that this is eventually limited, and the reason is shown here is that we can look at the different characteristics of the microenvironment as we get further away. This is kind of the important piece of it. The oxygen concentrations decline very, very rapidly. This is within a few cell layers, and the acid concentrations go up considerably, so that this acidosis and anhypoxia actually becomes the reason that tumor cells will not grow. And in fact, if you take a look, this is a, these are Dr. Carson in situ, stated for carbonic anhydrase 9, which we've talked about as a, before as an indicator of hypoxia. You can see that, in fact, hypoxia by that marker does exist in these regions deep to the basement membrane. After that, there are two possibilities that we find. One is that you can get, because there's two dominant environmental selection forces, there's hypoxia and acidosis. You need to convert to a glycolytic pathway so that you're using, you're generating energy without oxygen, and then you also have to become resistant to acidosis. Depending on which of these things come first, you get a different morphology, at least at the beginning. If you first get acid resistance and then get the glycolytic uptake, it actually predicts that those that population of glycolytic cells will initially produce these sort of nodular growth rates, morphology, until they eventually coalesce to kind of take over. And that actually gave us a testable prediction. And so what we did was look at large spheroids, which can grow in microgravity. It's going to be about a centimeter in diameter. And what we found was that you can maintain them for about 3 weeks, about 4 weeks. They actually develop a basement membrane-like structure. They develop areas of hypoxia deep to the basement membrane with both apoptosis and proliferation. So this is very much like the diffusion reaction kinetics of the duct that we predicted. And we can watch these cells over time. And so what we used is MCF7 cells. The reason was that the MCF7 was already resistant to acidosis, but did not have upregulated glycolysis. So we thought that this represented the population that we see here, and that in this population we should see just this kind of morphology. That's the initial population. This is upregulated GLUT1. This is the edge of the spheroid. You can see that in this case, on the day one, GLUT1 is upregulated only in the area that's hypoxic. This is sodium hydrogen exchange, and you can see it's diffusely upregulated. And when we looked at them at 15 to 30 days, what we see is, and stating for GLUT1, we see nodules of GLUT1 here in the normoxic area, pretty much identical to what was predicted. We've now looked at this in human specimens. This is human DCIS. GLUT1, this is a measure of the glycolytic phenotype, and you can see that in most of these, you see upregulation of GLUT1 in the hypoxic core. And what was interesting is that here, this is upregulated GLUT1. We began to see it in going straight down into areas of microinvasion. What we proposed is that in the evolutionary process, that the cells which have adapted to the hypoxic and acidic environment of the central region of the DCIS have a profound advantage. That is that they have constitutively upregulated glycolysis, which means they produce a very acidic environment. In the process, they also become adapted to acidosis. However, normal cells are not. Normal cells are really quite sensitive to an acidic environment. So you can see that they have a powerful proliferative advantage because they can now produce an environment which is toxic to their competitors and not to themselves. And we propose that this is actually a final era of carcinogenesis in which these populations now become highly invasive and in effect lead to this sort of microinvasive process. Even here, this is a different pattern of GLUT1 upregulation, but you can see that in this region of the edge of the DCIS. There's upregulated GLUT1, indicating that these cells are inappropriately glycolytic, even in an anomoxic region, and areas of microinvasion, also very highly upregulated GLUT1. This is NHE1. It's kind of interesting. So this is going to be, this is going to indicate an acidic environment. These are sodium hydrogen exchangers, and you can see that where it is upregulated, it's often associated with this kind of bulge and areas of microinvasion. So we've taken these lessons and actually produced what is a sort of a general model of carcinogenesis. That's in which we are primarily focused on microenvironmental the microenvironmental forces. So let's take this, the normal epithelium, basement membrane, blood vessels below, fibroblasts here, cells attached to each other. You know, how do they grow? Well, what they have is this huge area of potential space above the basement membrane. It's completely empty. Why don't they proliferate into there? Well, the reason is because of Anoikis. Basically, if they become detached from the basement membrane, they die. And because of crowding, they don't tend to crowd. So how, if you're a normal epithelial cell, how do you get to grow? Well, you have to have mutations or heritable changes that defeat Anoikis and at least remove some of the constraints from crowding. Cell contact inhibition. So what are the first things that are going to happen to a cell as it begins the process of carcinogenesis? Well, it's going to undergo mutations in the inhibitors for this process. Okay, now they begin to grow and they proliferate further away from the basement membrane. And because of the diffusion reaction kinetics, there's going to be initially one problem that they're going to have to face. If they continue to proliferate, they need proliferation signals that come from the basement membrane or from the blood. For example, they need the estrogen if they're breast cancer cells from the blood. Well, this estrogen now has to go over increasingly long distances. It's going to interact with estrogen receptors on the surfaces here. At some point, the concentrations are not going to be sufficient as these cells go further. In order to continue proliferation, so at this point in this kind of second phase of carcinogenesis, we propose that the microenvironmental selection forces are going to choose cells that become independent of outside proliferative signals. They're going to either upregulate their receptors. They're going to make their own growth receptors, autocrine growth receptors, or they're going to upregulate some of the pathways. So now, as we start to think about what the series of mutations that were shown in the Ferrand-Vogelsky model, we're now starting to make sense of them in terms of how they solve selection forces in the environment. As we go on, you then get hypoxia and acidosis, the kind of thing we talked about already. And then, very interestingly, you know, when the tumors break through the basement membrane, we have a whole new environment, and this is, I think, underappreciated, but we've talked about it a little bit here. This is the first time that the cells really come in contact with the mesenchymal cells. And it's these interactions which then must evolve in order to go from microinvasive cancer to a clinically apparent cancer. And we propose that this is actually an important third phase of carcinogenesis, which has really not been studied in any detail. So this is the it had to happen, didn't it? So this is the proposed model that the carcinogenesis pathway is really dominated not by a series of mutations that occur at random, but rather by a series of mutations that are selected because they adapt to extant microenvironmental selection forces, which change over time as the tumor morphology changes. So here are the principles of this. The microenvironment rules that this is not that carcinogenesis is not precisely a disease of the genes. The genes are driving this, but the reason that you get the phenotypic properties that you do in a cancer is because of the microenvironmental selection forces. Phenotypic necessity, that phenotype, not genotype, is what's selected. And here is something we call an equivalence principle. There's a lot of talk about how the genetic changes that occur in cancer and how they're different from one selection, from one tumor to another. What we propose is that a number of genetic changes can lead to the same adaptive advantage. In other words, if there's a pathway that you need to upregulate or downregulate, any component of that path will equally serve the function potentially. And so when we think about the genetics of tumors, we think we need to start looking at them in terms of what the phenotypic changes are. And I think what we'll be able to find is that we can cluster a lot of the genetics into subgroups or subpopulations, yielding the same proliferative advantage. Gradualism, a cancer requires all these proliferation barriers to be overcome. And the multivariate effects, it's not one solution to one problem. Sometimes the solution to one problem can affect the interaction with a number of the other barriers. So I'd like to just sensitize people to this idea of tumor as an evolutionary process, as a Darwinian process. It's very interesting to look at it as it develops, but it's also interesting to think about it in terms of our treatment. This has already been alluded to in the talks before. We can develop therapies, but the therapies are themselves selective microenvironmental forces. Tumors are going to evolve and adapt to those, and that this is a major challenge in finding therapeutic strategies. And we need to accept that, and we need to understand it as an evolving, adaptive structure. And our therapeutic strategies need to exploit this rather than be defeated by it. And I will again quote Charles Darwin. Thank you.